two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Two hip-hops exist on this planet. My hip-hop with all the elements of the hip-hop culture, which is revolutionary, and their hip-hop, owned by the rap industry. Boy and writer with knowledge of self to make hip-hopers' minds much tighter. Freedom fighter or revolutionary, my hip-hop's not in popular media or TV. Industries bring to my hip-hop means nothing. Shiny offerings can always buy them everything, so sing.
You're a corporate tool and a corporate con for world. Your deals are plastic, you should get your ass kicked.
See me working in communities for free. Money be changing what we named it originally. Wrongly named rap, right names emceeing. Writing not graffiti, b-boying not breakdancing. My hip-hop's actually in the accent that I speak. No wannabe American, fake accent speaking free. Can't sneak past the fact that my hip-hop's revolutionary. She's about community, can't buy her integrity.
My hip-hop is not your hip-hop, because your hip-hop just wants to make it pop. So stop. Our hip-hop is not their hip-hop, because their hip-hop is just a corporate cha-cha. My hip-hop is not your hip-hop, because your hip-hop just wants to make it pop. So stop. Our hip-hop is not their hip-hop, because their hip-hop is just a corporate cha-cha.
Song on the radio, appears on the TV show. You're just another multinationally owned freak show. Corporate hoe, justifying hip-hop's murder. Another revolution, sold to the lowest bidder. Us, yeah, it's not just words, it's all about action. My hip-hop's in every continent and nation. Freestyle session, global battle of the year. Hip-hop and Daba happening in Africa. If you wanna know the real deal about hip-hop, well, it's the new millennium and it's time for all these lies to stop. My hip-hop's still free, I'm controlled by the industry. Into dust we return, bringing focus to reality. My hip-hop's not about how much money you got or smoking pot to only having one shot. If it's bigger than my hip-hop, then your hip-hop is too small. My hip-hop's omnipotent, it's everything and all. My hip-hop's who we've always been, the essence of humanity. These circles are portals, we journey metaphysically.
My hip-hop is not your hip-hop, because your hip-hop just wants to make it pop. So stop. Our hip-hop is not their hip-hop, because their hip-hop is just a corporate cha-cha. My hip-hop is not your hip-hop, because
Hard Knock Radio, Davey D back here. Still here with my man Sammy Aleem and talking about your book, Freedom Moves, the Hip-Hop Pedagogy, Knowledge, and Futures. We have Emil X from South Africa. Why was he featured in the book? What was important about the work that Emil X did, and why was he covered?
So Emil YX of Cape Town, South Africa, is one of the most important hip-hop artists of our times. I'll say that, and that's not hyperbole. So Emil's been involved in hip-hop culture for decades. And one of the most beautiful things about Emil is that he started out making hip-hop for fun, for joy, etc., but he has for decades continued to march politically and to speak on all the political issues, all of the important racial justice issues, all of the activist issues, as he has fun, as he's one of the world's leading b-boys, as he teaches youth all over the community. These are youth who are oppressed and marginalized in the communities of the Cape Flats, and he offers them, through his organization, Heal the Hood, opportunities to on learning on how to navigate their future. So he's created schools of hip-hop. He has written 20 books now. He has dozens of albums out. Not just did he break ground with Black Noise as a pioneering South African hip hop group, but he has started offshoot groups. He's done hip hop theater. There's a performance known as Afrikaaps, which speaks very strongly against the apartheid regime and how they cut up South Africa into racial groups and linguistic groups and invented all of this conflict. And it speaks to the current situation that youth are going through right now in the Cape Flats. So, Emil, in terms of all of these issues, as an artist, as an activist, as a thinker, as a writer, as a scholar, as a b-boy, as a community organizer, is one of like the people that I hold up to really show the transformative power of hip-hop culture. In Freedom Moves, it's about freedom. It's about the way people use hip-hop all over the world to fight for freedom. And South Africa and Emil YX can't give us a better example of that than almost anybody.
I appreciate that. I've heard of Emil YX when apartheid was in South Africa. You know, that was one of the first names that I heard, and I think there was another group, Prophets, and you may have been a Prophets of the City
book as well. They're co-authoring the chapter. So Emil YX co-authors his chapter with Shaheen Arifdeen of Prophets of the City, the pioneering sort of giants in the game.
So let's talk a little bit about this. We're looking back at the 50th anniversary, and many people see you as a pioneering figure. How do you remember hip-hop, you know, emerging for you in Cape Town? Is there a difference, you know, is there a reason why it emerges in Cape Town more than Johannesburg? Because the first time I heard about hip hop in South Africa was from Cape Town. I hear a lot of house coming out of Johannesburg with Black Coffee and them, but hip hop was a Cape Town thing. So talk a little bit about that and why.
Yeah, my opinion is because the commonalities in the music. Because we are Port City, our parents were listening to the songs that eventually were sampled. That were used to, you know, create the first rap tracks and stuff, you know. Like, I clearly remember the sound of Sheik in the background.
Sheik, you mean?
Yeah, and in the background and of what Rapper's Delight and those type of tracks, you know. And it's because of that connection, my folks were listening to James Brown and all of the American artists. So when those things were sampled, it wasn't foreign. You know, whereas kids who are obviously from KwaZulu-Natal or from Johannesburg, the tribal experience that they had with their connection to the music and the language made it harder for them to actually transition, you know. And there's parallels between Black America and the so-called colored community, because we were displaced. And in some of the research I did, the South Bronx, 50,000 people were moved in District 6, 50,000 people were moved from that space, so forcibly removed to a different area, you know. So there are a lot of those type of parallels. Also, the fact that our community is completely disconnected from Africa, even though we are in Africa, because we are labeled as so-called colored or mixed, and so our disconnect from the continent makes us feel that we don't belong. And so when we heard a rap from the U.S., there's so many parallels, so many things we can identify with, so many, and then obviously because of apartheid and police brutality and the army, there's so many other things that we could connect to immediately, you know. So I think that history made it easier for us to connect, and then also support city, you know.
For people who don't know, let's give a little bit of South Africa 101. Because, you know, one of the things you all always talked about were these divide and conquer things that were going on. So how are people divided? You know, what's the categorization, and do people get along post apartheid, or is it more divided?
Ish, I'd say. That's something.
You got 10 seconds to answer that question.
Like, what? I think the divisiveness of apartheid was that how can we divide this black mass as much as possible? So my community is labeled as colored, but within that community, there's Griqua, there's the Malay community, there's even smaller divides within that community that is already considered mixed, right? And then there's people who are Xhosa and Zulu and Sotho and Pedi and like all these other tribal divides, you know? And so the apartheid regime actually physically moved people away from each other, you know, and freeways and train lines separated those people, and they still separate those people. And so at the same time, there's the legacy of that is the economic divide. Like, you can go live where the white folk live, but do you have the money to do that? So it's, you know, so it's embedded in the both in historically, as far as your language is concerned, as far as your culture is concerned, and then now politically as well, you know.
Do white folks still live there? I mean, the famous person that we know is Elon Musk. May he, you know, I say that with a cringe on my face. And then, you know, what's the name of that actress?
Charlize Theron,
right? So those are the two. But, you know, what's that like? I mean, where do white folks stand in South Africa now, post-apartheid? Do they rule behind the scenes or, you know, what's the deal?
Yeah, they rule behind the scenes, you know. That's just the nature of how money is. It's the same money globally, you know. And so there's the illusion of freedom that they sold, the Rainbow Nation idea that was sold with Mandela. And then there's the reality of a lot of people being exactly in the same situation that they were in before, you know, where they live, how they struggle to survive. And so those struggles are still very real, you know. And hence, like, the power of hip-hop in South Africa is as massive as it was when we started out, because it also contains information that liberates people. Because the education system, I left teaching as a qualified school teacher in 1993, just before the first election, because the content was Eurocentric. It is 2023 and the content is still Eurocentric.
Why?
Because of the negotiation of money. Money negotiated with the ANC and with the political parties to maintain that, to keep the information as white as possible so that they can mentally control the masses of the people still.
Wow. Let's talk hip-hop for a minute, and I want to walk through a timeline. Hip-hop in the States got involved with South Africa on two fronts. One, we know that the Zulu Nation that was started in the Bronx was inspired by the movie, I think it was Zulu. In that movie, they showed the British fighting against 4,000 Zulus, and that was like the British were, you know, they were outnumbered, like 100 of them, and they somehow won. But seeing all those people inspired folks in the Bronx and say, we want a Zulu Nation, and that emerged. So that's the first thing. Before most people who were young even knew about apartheid, even though it existed. Then the second thing that people really started to know was when the Sun City boycott came about, and everybody, Run DMC, Curtis Blow, Gil Scott-Heron, everybody was involved with that. And then the third iteration was when Artists Against Apartheid showed up, and that's when we started to hear your name, right? But we remember Stetsasonic and all those groups meeting at the Latin Quarter and then really taking a strong stance against apartheid and putting out records and the whole nine. Within those iterations, what did you know? You know, did you know about the Zulu Nation when it was in the Bronx before records? Did you know about the Sun City boycott? You know, what was your thoughts on that? And did you know when they started to form the Artists Against Apartheid? That's where your name pops up, so I assume you did. But let's go back to, you know, the forming of Zulu Nation.
Yeah, initially we only knew BAM from Planet Rock because we were B-boys, right? And then only through letters were we able to, and it's a weird, like, circle that came about. Because there's a Zulu Nation South Africa. King Jamo is the one that reached out to Afrika Bambaataa. And this is probably, I think, early 90s.
Is he an actual Zulu?
No, well, he has a connection to that history, but, like, he's not really aware. I think he's on his father's side. But he's labeled as so-called colored from the Cape Flats, so he's supposedly, you know, labeled mixed.
Right. Did the Zulus know about the Zulu Nation?
The Zulus only found out about the Zulu Nation when I think BAM started asking to connect with them, which was way later. This is like late 90s, I think, that they started reaching out to the Zulu Nation, actual Zulu Nation. I actually attended Zulu Nation anniversary in 1994. And I asked that question. I was like, how do we expand Zulu Nation in South Africa when Zulu Nation exists, and like as a group of so-called mixed race people pushing this agenda, do you think it's going to be as powerful, you know, because the tribal conflict is massive. Like, to ask a Xhosa Kidyo to join the Zulu Nation, he's like, hell no, I'm not doing that, you know. Even in the Cape Flats, it was difficult when people were not understanding what the origins of using that terminology. Like, we at some stage also called it the Universal Hip Hop Nation, just to get people to understand that the central force was hip hop, not necessarily like the tribe, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but to come back to your question about the other, like we knew about the Ain't Gonna Play Sun City because of the vinyl and people smuggling it in because it was illegal during apartheid to have.
I thought I was gonna ask. I heard it was illegal to have that record.
You're exactly. Right. So, but a lot of things get, you know, because it's a port city, things get smuggled in without them knowing. You know, so, and that's another reason why hip hop also took off in Cape Town, because of the connections people had to people who were at sea and were bringing in cassettes and bringing in vinyl that they couldn't otherwise get, you know.
Oh, because, so again, being a port city, as we were talking about Barcelona, that allows the connection easier.
Yeah, exactly. And then also there's a, like Cape Town has a huge, like because there's a lot of mixture going on. There's also familiarity, like half of our family is a Muslim, half of our family is a Christian. There's much more tolerance in the city. And so it's easier for something like hip hop to land in Cape Town than elsewhere in the country. You know, people are always experimenting, and there's a hip hop essentially is almost like what in Cape Town we call it the pochicos. It's like a potpourri, like a mixture of things, you know, and it's a mixed city, so.
So Prophets of the City, were you a part of that, or that was just Shanine, right? So when you all start doing hip-hop and when Shanine is doing hip-hop, Prophets of the City, did y'all got banned? Did he get banned? What was the deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, they were, like, this was towards the end of legalized apartheid. So the Shanine them were the first signed group. And Shaheen them took a very political stance with the album. Our crew came from a b-boy background, so a lot of our music was like went in a different direction. You know, hip hop was all about being different. It wasn't about copying what everybody else was doing. And so, like we addressed issues differently from Prophets of the City. But their album got banned because it's a very weird reason. Like in one of the scenes in their music video, they take the picture of the then president and put it in the fridge and say, yo, chill out, homeboy. That's what they say. And then the album gets banned. And I'm like, they banned it for that? Like, what? You know, and when they get banned, they, Shaheen and the members of Prophets of the City start diving in. It's at the same time that I had written to Word Up magazine and received copies of Blacked Out Through Whitewash and Dr. Francis Chris Welsing's ISIS papers and the Browder files and Behold the Pale Horse and all these books, right? And we shared it. We like photocopied. Everybody has copies until you can't copy it any longer. And then POC and our crew start, we cut ties with record labels and we start doing things independently. And we start actually sharing that information in rhyme. And so it makes it impossible to get an album released. And POC, Prophets of the City, then decide to leave South Africa and to be based in London, you know. And we decide to go underground and start teaching hip hop as a culture throughout the country. So we travel and we teach b-boying. We you know, so basically build the culture from the ground up throughout the country.
So you know, it's interesting because it shows the power of culture. We know, you know, we're sitting here, you know, a week after Harry Belafonte passed, and we know about the relationship he had with Miriam Makeba, and her music was banned, right? You know, and he was making a point like, let's record you and help blow it up. I guess under apartheid and even now, they are clear about the influence and the impact that culture has, and so there's a lot of policing of it.
Definitely. And you know, it's like, I mean, Sammy was mentioning the play we did, Afrikaps, and there's a huge amount of fear that the content of that gets spread, and so it's silenced. You know, when we did the production, I cracked up because everybody was very excited.
Afrikaps is a play you did. What is it about?
It's about the black history of the language Afrikaans, and Afrikaner comes from the word Afrikaans. And the language is actually taken from our community. It's actually a stolen language from the people of Cape Town. And so this is scary to them because like their entire illusion of their idea of like white, their white collective or race is based on this fact that this language that they took from our community is Dutch. And it's completely one of the biggest lies.
Wait, it isn't Dutch.
It is a mixture, Creole language, using Dutch as one of the like foundational languages. But the way that it's spoken shows the mixture of other languages and where it actually comes. The first written version of the language is actually in phonetic Arabic. Right, so immediately proving that the history of the language is based in Cape Town. And so when we do the production, you see the same mechanisms of the past at work to silence it, to stop it from getting to the rest of the country and getting a lot of young people to be exposed to it, you know. And I think that, to me, when we did it, I was aware of that was going to happen because of my involvement on the ground with trying to change things. The other members of the production, they were excited. They were like, yo, we're changing things. And I remember telling them, we're doing this at UCT, the University of Cape Town, Baxter Theatre. There's no way they're going to let this thing expand to the rest of the country, you know. But at the same time, when I said it, it was like, how do I create a space where I can get this information spread? How do I pass what I learned to kids in my community? How do I get them to write about it? How do I get them to spread it? And then created a school, a hip-hop school, called Mixed Mensa with a group of kids from Lavendale. And once I created that school, I realized the ways that you can solve the problem using that information. And then the guys that I taught now teach in the school. So 14 schools sharing that exact same information and seeing the kids they taught sharing that information with their parents.
So each one teach one.
Exactly. You know what I
mean? Emil YX is our guest out of South Africa, talking to him this afternoon, if you're just tuning in. You said you were aware of the Sun City. Did you feel a certain way, or were you rapping when that came out? Because that was about 83, 84. Did you feel like, how come we're not on there? Or would that have even been allowed?
No, this is, we were still b-boying back then. When that
You were dancing?
Yeah, we were dancing back then. So definitely.
But they could have put you in a video.
Oh, no, that was, you know, the bottom line about that era was that, like, we were learning from what we're seeing in the U.S., you know. And I think the fact that, because Black America is the epitome of cool as far as any person of color on the planet is concerned. So seeing what was being done, and then like breadcrumbs, right? You see that and you're like, oh shoot, this is what they also did. This is the other ways that they went about trying to bring change in the United States, right? So seeing that introduced us to the other things and making us hungry to write, to find more information. Because once you hear that information, you're like, where is this? Why can't I find this anywhere? And then you realize, oh, cultural boycott. Then like you try and figure out ways around it. Like, how do I get this information? You know, and like the more you step towards finding that information finds you, you know?
But it's interesting. They were well aware, the apartheid government, of all this stuff. So they were like, let's shut it down. Let's crazy. So they were studying us.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the South African government went around the world checking out versions of, like, white supremacy and how to best, you know, use the techniques in the United States, the techniques that they saw elsewhere in the world and implemented in South Africa. Because it was, you know, the foundational, like, how do I implement this information and have a government that's willing to do that. You know, whereas elsewhere, the world's scrutiny is obviously much more than what it was in South Africa, you know.
So when the Artists Against Apartheid in the States emerged in the late 90s during the Golden Era, you had people like Queen Latifah, for example, do Ladies First, right? That was a very subversive move. If people have not understood that story, we had Fat Five Freddy on to talk about it. She did a song called Ladies First. And then when they went to go produce it, they tried to play it off like, yeah, we're just having her knock pieces off a chessboard, right? But it was part of a larger thing, which was to make it an anti-apartheid video, right? So they showed it Soweto riots or uprisings, the whole nine, right? So the powerful thing, and it goes on MTV and it's all around the world, but did it come to South Africa? And if it did, what was the reaction when this anti-apartheid video showed up with Queen Latifah? Was she banned?
Well, I don't know if she was banned, but they definitely didn't play that. They would never play that on television. And we were aware of the fact that, you know, when we saw the video through other friends who had sent VHS copies, So that's the way that we got exposed to a lot of people were, you know, a lot of the information, you know, people don't understand your, if they thought that you were getting information that was, you know, against the apartheid regime, that package would never reach you, you know? And so people like the young B-boys, people like, ah, they're just getting a B-boy video. And on that video, all this like MTV footage, you're like, damn, look what she's doing. You know what I mean? So we were blown away by, because when we saw it, we immediately understood what she was, what the video was about, you know? And a lot of the initial, like we used to call in to get like songs played by Run DMC. They were like, no, we don't know what you're talking about. You know, because the scene was much, the underground scene, the hip hop scene was so much further ahead of the average South African. People had no idea. I mean, and that's actually why we went around the country to teach, because we wanted the culture to grow, and we knew that they wouldn't assist in any way to do that for us, you know.
So, Mir, let me ask you this. You know, many of us, at least in the Bay and in the States, we know South Africa for its house music, Black Coffee. There's a huge house music scene there, right? Very cosmopolitan. And a lot of it seems to be centered more around Johannesburg than it is Cape Town. Has hip-hop in that Black Coffee house scene, has that merged at all? Do y'all talk? Do you see each other and go, yo, Coffee, man, me and you need to do a little something, something. What's that like? Because there have been exchanges. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the States that has been done with those South African house artists.
Yeah, there's been hip-hop collaborations as well, you know, with names like WHP. And these again, Johannesburg is the industry center, and so a lot of Cape Town artists don't really, they're not signed because it's a small community. Labels are like, why would we sign you? Because people in South Africa still buy according to color. You know, if you're colored, they're like, I don't think I want to listen to that because your accent is different. And I didn't know that until I came to the U.S. the first time, you know. And so in South Africa, even when Black Noise and POC put out albums, this is during apartheid, and there's much more of a desire to be the Black collective, where as soon as freedom comes, people start separating themselves. Xhosa, Zulu, the tribes start dividing themselves. And the industry only markets what is danceable, because the industry is white controlled and it doesn't want you to be asking questions. It doesn't want you to be, you know, rebellious and to educate the masses of Black people in South Africa. So house is easy because house is dance music, right? And so it doesn't cause any riff. I mean, Kwaito was another example. Amapiano is the latest example.
Right, that's the big thing now.
And again, it's only allowed to spread by these industry giants because it's not confrontational.
But if they start to put messages in the music, they will shut it down.
There's no way they allow the messages to come through.
Even in 2023? So Black folks who are in charge would shut it down?
Well, the Black folks in charge are like the, what did Biko call them? The Black upholders of white supremacy. Right. that's essentially what it is, right? Because their money will be destroyed if they speak out for the benefit of Black people. That's the nature of how things are. They're only allowed to, marketing is only allowed when you play along with the system's exploitation of the masses of the people.
You know, when we talk about South Africa, they hold up Nelson Mandela, but you know, a couple of times in this thing, you kind of alluded to other people. So who are the heroes? You know, like here in the States, they may say Martin Luther King, and he's a hero. But people be like Huey Newton and Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer, right? So if we were to look at the pantheon of heroes on your wall, who are they? Stephen Biko?
Yeah, I mean, definitely Steve Biko. There's also, like in my community, there's a guy called Neville Alexander, who was actually on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. And a lot of the people that I look to is local, because I wanting to get more young people to realize that it was a collective. And even Mandela said he stands on the shoulders of giants that have gone before. And I think it's important that we don't speak of individuals, but speak of the collective. You know, because we collectively took the first step towards liberation of South Africa. you know, and it takes all of us to do it, not just like these icons. And Mandela did what he could, you know. In I think a lot of young people, especially now with EFF and Julius Malema and like a new generation of young people who understand that we were sold out economically in the country, and some of them are blaming Mandela for doing that, which is, you know, they weren't there to see what he was shown. Right. And I think what he was shown was horrible, because I know that they probably showed him what they did to Patrice Lumumba and other heroes, Sankara, through Africa, and showed him that they would do the same to South Africa, you know. And I think that he was like, yo, we can't allow this to happen here. You know what I mean?
Where does Winnie Mandela sit in terms of...
On top, man. She stuck with us no matter what, you know. And they tried to make it sound like there was something wrong with her, you know, towards the end. But we knew, because she was with us when we were struggling in the streets, when all we had was like a brick in our hand to fight the army. She was there, you know. She stood with us, and she was willing to take the fall and be confronted with like the hell of apartheid, you know. While many leaders went into exile, and she probably was given the opportunity, but she didn't.
She stayed there
with us. So we hold in high regard, you know. She is the mother of our nation as far as we're concerned, you know.
As we close out, where's hip-hop going in South Africa? And two, as we look at the United States walking towards fascism with the Trumps and the DeSantoses and an entire party and infrastructure that supports them, is South Africa in danger of one day returning to apartheid again?
I think the masses of the people are being blinded by what they're allowed to see, you know. In the same way that, like, I reached out to write to Word Up magazine, that's what's necessary. We need to look elsewhere, and we actually need to have conversations. Like, I've had conversation. I'm in Atlanta at the moment, and I'm speaking to people that are staunch Republicans and like who supported Trump. And then I speak to them, and they're like, "Yeah, you know, you're right about what you're saying." But I took the time to speak to them, and I feel like while I'm here, I see a lot of people just ignoring each other instead of having these conversations, because we have a lot more in common than the differences. And I'm saying that to preface that, like, in South Africa, it's the same. Like, it's the usage of tribal divides, it's the usage of, they've always used race, they've always used religion, they've always used politics to divide the masses of the people. But the masses of the people have the same needs, you know. And once we realize we have more in common than these differences they sell us, then we are mass, you know.
How did Truth and Reconciliation go? How did that fly with you and others?
I switched the TV off, because I was, within the first week, I realized it was like we were dealt our pain, and nobody took blame for it. Nobody was locked up. So it was a clever technique to make people appear to be you know, like, sorry for what they did, you know, to have remorse. But they didn't have any remorse. They just said what they did, and we had to be stuck with the pain, you know. And I feel there was no justice from what took place. At the same time, I mean, none of the big businesses that paid for apartheid and that benefited from apartheid were hauled over the coals or asked for any economic reparation, you know, which is really how you solve the problem in South Africa, or even here in the United States, with black people still not receiving any reparations for slavery, you know. So I feel like that's, once they can have that conversation, then we can say, you know, the reconstruction and development conversation, or the RDP, or whatever they wanted to, the hook, key phrases they sold during that time, seemed very much for the white power structure versus the benefit of the black majority.
Right. It made somebody feel comfortable, not us. Amir YX, thank you so much for joining us. Concluding this interview with him, we're going to listen to some music. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Second coming, second coming, be the fire around this soul, fire around this soul, the fire around this, blaze it up, blaze it up, blaze it up. I wanna let my soul shine bright and brighten up the night. I wanna let my soul shine bright and make everything alright. Oh, now, oh, now, I see your light, I see your.
shine bright. I see your light. I see your light shine bright. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. You know, children of the light, they be not black nor white, they be not wrong, them right. It's time to stand up and fight. Get up and stand up and fight for your right. I light a fire, I burn a tire. I give respect to the ones that inspire. Now take it higher, come join the choir. From this revolution we won't retire. Revolution nothing but change, so why you fear? Children of the light, it's time to gather near. Here, we can make your soul shine bright. Here, we can make what's wrong come right. So blaze up your fire, I wanna tonight. Let my soul shine bright and brighten up the night. I wanna let my soul shine bright and make everything alright. I see your light, I see your light shine bright. I see your light, I see your light shine bright. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. They say the second coming will be fire and brimstone. Let your soul shine bright and blaze a fire of your own. They say the stars are penals in the curtains of night, but they be holes made by souls escaping dark for the light. A light at the end of this tunnel is where we drawn right. Might be the source, but we be all godlike. Right, we energy a part of a whole. Right, we can't be destroyed, it's only physical. That's why Mr. Devious lives on in us all. I energy cannot be destroyed, so he will never die. No more compromise, no more concession. No selling your soul or learning empty lessons. Which lessons yourself with, so I have concern. The lessons we learn, lessons how bright we burn. Our fire extinguished, so we learn to earn. Them worthless inside, so for bling bling them you earn. Them you earn. Them you earn. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. Shine bright and brighten up the night. I wanna let my soul shine bright and make everything alright. I see your light, I see your light shine bright. I see your light, I see your light shine bright. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. Follow him, follow him, follow him. We must follow him, follow him, follow him. We don't need no
it's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication lead to complication. My emancipation don't fit your equation.
Welcome to Opinion Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host Amir Cornish, Decolonized Academy graduate and Poor Magazine Youth Poly Scholar reporter with Poly Scholar and poet Mudia Silencio and Poe Poet and Poly Scholar Tiny.
The struggle of our mamas is real. This poem is in honor of homeless mothers and poor mothers, low-wage mothers and no-wage mothers, welfare mothers and three-job working mothers. This poem is in honor of daughters. This poem is in honor of Sophia, a 10-year-old baby girl we lost because the struggle of pobreza, of poverty, of false borders, of addiction, of trauma, of violence that you don't even know where it comes from. We're holding Sophia in our hearts. She was killed inside her own home. Some people might be trying to blame somebody. We're trying to lift up that these traumas kill and that Sophia is everybody's baby. And capitalism kills.
On this segment of Poor People's Radio, we will speak with Marta Escudero from Fuego Storytelling in Tonga Territory, a.k.a. Southern Califaslan, then to Sister Mama Jumba, poverty scholar and leader at Parent Voices, on the recent budget genocide threat by San Francisco mayor of child care services for poor and houseless parents. But first, we will speak with one of the warriors' comrades from the F-12 in Occupy Elamu, a.k.a. Frisco, who've been fighting against police terror, racism, and class hate of that settler town,
Welcome, comrade Dogtown Drew. What's up?
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor, a blessing, and a privilege.
We wanted to talk about propaganda. Tell us about propaganda. Mm-hmm.
The police are actually using money to promote and glorify and create a sense of reverence for the police. It's trying to establish culturally and societally that police are these heroic fixtures in our community. But propaganda is a broad spectrum. Hollywood is very complicit in partaking in propaganda with these movies. I tell my partners all the time, like, I grew up watching Axel Foley and Beverly Hills Cop. I thought he was the coolest MF-er alive. That was by design. That's like one end of the spectrum. But then it's all throughout. It's the normalization of these Nazi pig, pilgrim, military occupiers. It's the desensitizing us to having a military occupation in our own community.
And I love that you expanded it into Hollywood, because we know that that's never ending for like the military industrial complex. Then there's these little things like Joe's Ice Cream doing free ice cream for the cops.
It's particularly egregious because you could see the framing is that they're trying to provide service to these children. You'll be bringing your child around a Nazi pig with a pistol on his hip that we know who those pistols are for. You're trying to indoctrinate these children and you're trying to buy their favor with dessert.
Do you know any other alternative stuff like that that we can offer some of those black and brown folks? Because let's be real, you know, crime is real.
So people have this narrow perspective on the police providing intervention that keeps people safe. But in reality, if we have our liberation and we get that pig boot off our neck, we don't need anybody to intervene. If I'm the pigs, I'm putting y'all in a bucket, and then I'm telling y'all that y'all need me to keep y'all from fighting each other within that bucket. But we're coming from a perspective as revolutionaries saying, leave us out of this bucket. Dump that bucket over, get the hell out our face and our community where we can be liberated, peaceful, and free. I know that we have to think of immediate alternatives to utilizing police, and we can have that conversation, but ultimately we need liberation, and that will alleviate the necessity for violence intervention.
Follow Dogtown Drew, family. Follow F12, all power to the people.
Right on, power to the people.
What you want and what you will, working for your dollar bill. Sad to see the old slave mill. It's grinding slow but grinding still. Walking home, my youth gets killed. Police free to shoot at will. Sad to see the old slave mill. It's grinding slow but grinding still.
Up next, we'll be speaking to Sister Mama Jumbai on the recent budget genocide threat by San Francisco Mayor of child care services for poor and houseless parents.
We're dealing with these power trickster mayors and their role in the war on the poor. It's not only attacking our elders, our relatives on the streets, our folks living in homes check by check, but it also goes after our babies. So we are blessed to have a fellow sister warrior, teacher, reacher, bad chingona sister and co-founder of Decolonize Academy and founding member of Poor Magazine, and a powerful leader with Parent Voices on a phone. Hey, Junebug.
Thank you, Tiny, for that intro. Yes, I'm Junebug. I'm from SF, born and raised here, and currently doing advocacy work with San Francisco Parent Voices. We got a serious situation going on down here in the city. Our childcare funding is being attacked left and right. Right now, we have the mayor's proposal by London Breed that basically would create a 13% cut to the Department of Early Childcare. In addition to that, her proposal would also attack funding stream source for funding Baby Prop C. Now, Baby Prop C is an ordinance that was passed by the voters in San Francisco in 2018. And it was already attacked on the ballot because at the time Lyndon Breed was running for mayor. She also had Proposition D on the ballot, which was a poison bill to baby Prop C. So from jump, this proposition has been under attack. Basically, what that means by a poison bill is that if Proposition D wins at the time in 2018, that baby Prop C would automatically lose. Well, we had a victory. Baby Prop C passed. It was won. The voters in San Francisco in 2018 said, yes, we want baby Prop C. Baby Prop C would be a total game changer to the childcare system. It would create a more equitable system. It would help providers actually have a living wage. It would help fund early child education. It would create a capacity for expansion, help the workforce development in early child education. It would create an educator salary support for grant reserve. So, for instance, we have a lot of providers and early child educators that really need a lot of support around special education. We have a lot of children with special needs. I'm a mom with a daughter with cerebral palsy, and we need a lot of funding sources for our children with special needs. So this would help, you know, in so many ways. And so after this ordinance was passed, Howard Jarvis Tax Association came along and sued us. So now we're attacked again, held up in the courts, in litigation. But while it's held up in the courts, Baby Prop C is still collecting funding. And we won. So we won that attack. And now we're ready to implement Baby Prop C. We know that after basically 2020, when the whole pandemic happened with COVID, a lot of childcare centers actually closed down. So this would actually help with our infrastructure to help provide support for childcare. Childcare is so necessary. What the mayor is trying to propose is reducing that commercial rent tax. One of the ways Baby Prop C would get funded is that commercial rent tax on corporations that make over $1 million, that funding would be going to Baby Prop C to fund all these wonderful things. Now, these over $1 million corporations can afford to pay that tax. And so that would just generate so much revenue for our children, especially our children that are 6 years old, our little babies. And so prior to that attack, like I said, it was already held up in litigation until 2021. Well, it was accumulating money. It has a reserve now, a balance of $400 million. And in the mayor's budget proposal, she would like to earmark like $160 million in that reserve. It's like another attack on Baby Prop C. So we really cannot allow the mayor to manipulate the city, to manipulate the Board of Supervisors. And that's exactly what she's doing. She's using language like, oh, we can be flexible with funds. We should be able to amend propositions. This funding has been sitting there. Well, one, the funding's been sitting there because it was held up in a lawsuit. And so that's why it's been sitting there. And no, it's not okay to say you can be flexible. The voters passed this. This is what they want. So it's a total disrespect. And I also just want to mention that some of the Board of Supervisors, such as Melgar, has been a great support. So I just want to give a shout out to Melgar. If you are in San Francisco, support by writing your Board of Supervisor from your district.
Support Parent Voices SF on IG. Also,
thank you.
Parent Voices on Facecrack and InstaScam.
Parent Voices SF, fighting for child care, advocating for child care.
Love you and appreciate you, and we're right there with you.
And finally, we will speak with Marta Escudero from Fuego Storytelling in Tonga Territory, a.k.a. Southern Califaslan.
Our sister warrior from Occupied Tongva, reclaiming homes. First of all, tell listeners a little bit about the Chingona action that you guys did a couple years back.
I'm here in Ochunga, the place of the roses, known as El Sereno, California, Northeast LA area, stolen Tongva land. And Caltrans has had vacant homes, almost 200 of them, some for 30 years because they were planning to build a freeway in this area, but people fought against it. This area is a lot of brown folk, and they didn't want a freeway in this area. And so they fought against it. They won, but nonetheless, Caltrans stayed with these homes. And people started moving out, and some of them were vacant for 30 years while people are suffering on the streets and we have a so-called housing crisis. So then we took action right on the lockdown of COVID, which was March 14, 2020, and we reclaimed some of these homes. We were able to obtain a 2-year contract with a housing authority here in Los Angeles, and that contract ended already. So they want to evict these families, and we refused to leave because this is our community, and also because we think it's really illogical to have us out when they still have a housing crisis. Everything's super unaffordable in California. And here in Los Angeles, we actually have surplus housing. We have 3 empty homes per 1 unhoused person. And so to me, that should be against the law. That is really despicable, especially during the COVID crisis, to have people be suffering and dying. And it's like the system is literally what's killing us. It's not COVID. It's not any other diseases. The system, the healthcare system, the housing system, all these systems of oppression, you know, that uphold capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy, it's what's killing us because the people that are on the streets are the most vulnerable. A lot of elders, a lot of Black folk, a lot of queer trans folk that are literally dying. They say an average of 5 unhoused people die a day in LA. To me, it's really frustrating and disgusting how these politicians, a lot of them Black and brown people that look like us, uphold the same system. Yeah. We can't fall for that anymore. Not every brother's a brother. I don't want you to represent me. So we're going to go to court. We're going to take it to court.
I think that one of the pieces that you articulated, right, is our skin folk, and all is our kinfolk. They had locked up those homes. Did your relatives, did your familias down there, were they about it? Were they worried about the police?
Yeah, Moms for Housing was actually my personal inspiration in doing this move, and I'm really grateful for them and their courage. Here in reclaiming our homes, we were able to take these homes, but then later on in November, another group tried to take homes, and they were actually brutalized by the California Highway Patrol. Once you have community, I feel it's a little better. You become a lot more courageous because you know that you're not alone.
So you're taking these fools to court. And what do you think is the next move on that one?
Well, we're going to try to convince the jury that what we did was righteous and we deserve to stay here. And, you know, not all laws are moral.
If you don't already know the work that they're doing in Tongva territory, check it out. Follow these badass warriors, Fuego Storytelling.
It's funny how money changes situations. Miscommunication leads to complications.
So that's all for this segment of Poor News Network. If you want to hear any of our Poor People's Revolutionary Radio, you can subscribe to Poor Magazine SoundCloud channel or find and subscribe to Poor News Network on YouTube. Thanks to Anita Johnson, David D, and Anthony Fest for the media access, and all of you for listening.
Hard knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk, don't stop. EMN at it again, Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation, simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat it and any from the steel gray boots. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I need with a breeze. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.